Chapter 1971, Kurt Flood, Dred Scott in Spikes. The game. Washington Senators 8, Oakland Athletics nothing. Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Stadium in Washington, D.C. Attendance was 45,061. It was Monday, April 5th, 1971, and the weather was spectacular. Hall of Famers, Senators first base coach Nellie Fox and manager Ted Williams, Athletics right fielder Reggie Jackson and manager Dick Williams. Game highlights. Pitcher Vida Blue's breakout season got off to a rather inauspicious start. The 21-year-old lefty lasted only until the second inning against the lowly Senators. But after this opening day disappointment, Blue was a different pitcher the rest of the season. He started the 1971 All-Star Game for the American League, the first of 6 All-Star Game appearances over his 17-year career, and won the Cy Young Award with an astounding 24-8 record and a microscopic 1.82 ERA. On the opposite side this day, Senators ace Dick Bosman tossed a 6-hit, complete game shutout. The story. Hopeful but skeptical, Washington Senators fans filled RFK Stadium on a picture-perfect Monday afternoon. Without support from his third-year manager, Ted Williams, unlikable owner Bob Short had revamped the roster around his 2 returning stars, pitcher Dick Bosman and the home run hero of my youth, Frank Howard. Fans were hoping for wins. Short was hoping for ticket sales. The owner was losing money and threatened to move his team out of the nation's capital if business did not improve. Short gambled on a pair of big-name superstars who, in the late 1960s, had been the absolute best in the game at their respective positions. Yet in 1970, each played little or no baseball. The first was Denny McLain, who was acquired in an 8-player trade with the Detroit Tigers. He had won the American League Cy Young Award during the Tigers' 1968 World Series championship season and again in 1969, starting 82 games over that span, pitching an arm-numbing 661 innings. But McLain's off-the-field troubles resulted in multiple suspensions in 1970, just 14 starts, and only 91 innings on the mound. Short's other marquee acquisition started in center field on opening day 1971. Kurt Flood played the final forgettable 13 games of his otherwise remarkable major league career for perhaps the only team that would have him, the Washington Senators. He was arguably the best center fielder in the game by the end of the 1960s, earning 7 straight gold gloves from 1963 to 69, playing for the powerhouse St. Louis Cardinals. Flood was a bona fide superstar, playing on a team that included future Hall of Famers Bob Gibson and Lou Brock, and won 3 National League pennants and 2 World Series. Yet it was his unwillingness to play in 1970 that earned Flood an extraordinary place in sports history as he selflessly challenged baseball's reserve clause all the way to the Supreme Court. Flood had played 12 years with the Cardinals, loved St. Louis, and was popular with the fans. But things started to unravel for him after the 1968 season. He was unfairly blamed for his team's World Series loss to the Tigers after misplaying a ball in center field late in Game 7. 2 runs scored, Detroit won the game 4-1, and the series. During the offseason, Flood strained his relationship with ownership and fans, publicly demanding a 24% raise to $90,000 for 1969. The Cardinals ultimately gave in to his demands, but the damage was done. In those days, players routinely accepted what management offered. In October 1969, Flood's career as a Cardinal came to an end when he and catcher Tim McCarver were traded to the Philadelphia Phillies. Flood refused to go and explored his options. The path he pursued with unwavering conviction was a lonely journey that cost him the rest of his career and lit a fuse that changed the game for future players, most of whom don't even know his name. Flood had spent 31 years preparing for martyrdom. As a young minor league player in the 1950s, Flood experienced the same racist indignities of the Deep South that more closely were associated with the Negro Leagues or Jackie Robinson, 19 years Flood senior. In his review of the 2011 HBO documentary, The Curious Case of Curt Flood, Alan Barr explained that Curt's righteous activism had been seeded, nurtured, and stoked for decades. Quote, born in Houston in 1938, Flood was raised in the relatively tolerant Oakland, California. His mother, who had fled the intense racial bigotry of the pre-World War II South, never let him forget what things had been like where she grew up. And in 1962, having little idea of what he was about to encounter, the 24-year-old Flood went to Mississippi to join his idols, Dr. Martin Luther King and Jackie Robinson, to support the nonviolent protests organized by the NAACP. Less than 2 years later, Flood battled racial prejudice closer to home when he rented a house for his pregnant wife and four small children in the Oakland suburb of Alamo. In a public and tense confrontation, they were denied access by an owner who didn't know they were black when he signed the lease. He blocked the entrance with a loaded shotgun. Flood knew injustice, sued the owner in court, and won. 5 years later, this same search for justice drove Flood to take on the baseball establishment. Flood felt strongly that at some point, players should be free to choose where they played. To Flood, baseball's unique reserve system amounted to legalized slavery. The reserve clause, paragraph 10A of the Uniform Players Contract, in effect, bound a player in perpetuity to his original team or any team to which he might be traded or sold. Flood did not want to go to the Philadelphia Phillies. In his 1971 autobiography, The Way It Is, he called Philadelphia the, quote, northernmost southern city in America. He audaciously decided to pursue an antitrust lawsuit against Major League Baseball. He reached out to Marvin Miller, head of the nascent Major League Baseball Players Association, the MLBPA. At the time, Miller's greatest challenge was convincing well-paid players to stop accepting paternalism and understand their true value. Just as Brooklyn Dodgers owner Branch Rickey needed to find a Jackie Robinson a generation earlier to finally break down baseball's racial barrier, so too did Miller need someone courageous enough to take on the fight if they were to eventually break down the game's feudal structure. In Curt Flood, he found a willing pawn, poised to make the first move, knowing it was unlikely he would still be in the game when the king was toppled. Not many players in those early years wanted to talk about the legalities of the reserve clause, Miller told HBO in 2011. During a four-hour lunch in December 1969, Miller warned Flood of the price he'd likely pay to pursue this. I told him that given the court's history of bias toward the owners and their monopoly, he didn't have a chance in hell of winning. More important than that, I told him even if he won, he'd never get anything out of it. He'd never get a job in baseball again. It almost didn't matter what I said, Miller concluded. I realized this is really a man of principle. A determined Flood asked if moving forward would benefit other players. I told him yes, Miller said, and those to come. That's good enough for me, Flood responded. Still trying to fathom the complex character sitting across the table, Miller simply said, you're a union leader's dream. Flood accompanied Miller to a meeting later that month with the MLBPA player representatives, one from each major league team. They voted unanimously to cover the costs of the lawsuit, but it was clear to Flood that this would be the only measurable support he would get from his contemporaries. Teammate McCarver said, sadly, what came out of that meeting was that even though the association was going to cover the expenses, Curt was isolated, and he felt that isolation. His best friend in baseball, teammate Bob Gibson, asked the rhetorical question followed by an answer that could have come from almost any active major leaguer. Was I behind Curt? Absolutely. About 10 steps back in case there's fallout. Miller added to the legal team a former colleague from the United Steelworkers, Arthur Goldberg. Goldberg had the right resume for the job: labor secretary under President John Kennedy and associate justice on the U.S. Supreme Court from 1962 to 65. Together with Flood and MLBPA General Counsel Richard Moss, the four men carefully crafted a masterpiece. The December 24, 1969 letter from Flood to Commissioner Bowie Kuhn has been analyzed, critiqued, and applauded for generations for its pointed simplicity. Writing in 2019 on the document's 50th anniversary, Mark Carrig of The Athletic wrote, quote, "The letter consists of just five sentences. It is written in the first person, signed by a sole author, and addressed to just one man. It uses no similes, no metaphors, no literary flourishes. There is no mention of free agency or the reserve clause or slavery, though each of those ideas is embedded within its 128 words. From its austerity flows an authority that endures." More than 20 years after signing it, Flood shared his retrospective as part of Ken Burns' 1994 documentary, Baseball. I guess you have to really have to understand who that Curt Flood was, Flood recalled. "I was a child of the 60s, a man of the 60s. During that period of time, this country was coming apart at the seams. We were in Southeast Asia. Good men were dying for America and the Constitution. In the southern part of the United States, they were marching for civil rights, and Dr. King had been assassinated. We had lost the Kennedys. And to think that merely because I was a professional baseball player, I could ignore what was going on outside the walls of Busch Stadium was truly a hypocrisy. And now I find all of those rights that all of these great Americans were dying for, I didn't have in my own profession. By God, this is America. I'm a human being. I'm not a piece of property. I'm not a consignment of goods." He then read the letter aloud. "Dear Mr. Kuhn, after 12 years in the major leagues, I do not feel that I am a piece of property to be bought and sold irrespective of my wishes. I believe that any system which produces that result violates my basic rights as a citizen and is inconsistent with the laws of the United States and of the several states. It is my desire to play baseball in 1970, and I am capable of playing. I have received a contract offer from the Philadelphia Club, but I believe I have the right to consider offers from other clubs before making any decisions. I therefore request that you make known to all of the major league clubs my feelings in this matter and advise them of my availability for the 1970 season. Sincerely yours, Curt Flood." 6 days later, Kuhn acknowledged Flood was not a piece of property, but that he could not see its applicability in this situation, and went on to write, "I cannot comply with the request in the second paragraph of your letter." While Flood sat out the 1970 season, his case against the commissioner played out in U.S. District Court. Of the 24 player representatives who just 5 months earlier had voted unanimously to support Flood's case financially, not one, nor any other active player, expressed public support or visited during the three-week trial, not even his St. Louis teammates who were in town for a series against the Mets. A few former players appeared to testify. One even approached Curt and whispered words of encouragement. "Keep your head up. You're doing the right thing." Flood's eyes filled with tears. The former player was Jackie Robinson. In August, the court ruled in favor of the owners. Quote, "Since baseball remains exempt from the antitrust laws unless and until the Supreme Court or Congress holds to the contrary," wrote Judge Irving Ben Cooper, "we have no basis for proceeding to the underlying question of whether baseball's reserve system would or would not be deemed reasonable if it were, in fact, subject to antitrust regulation." Flood's legal team began the appeal process, but his life was falling apart. He was deeply in debt. He had stopped paying child support to his ex-wife 2 years earlier. His non-baseball business interests were failing, and he had little income. After the trial, He fled the country to avoid the stress and harassment that accompanied the high-profile fight that bore his name. In November 1970, Flood got a call from the Senators. Short had acquired Kurt's rights in a trade with the Phillies and offered him $110,000 to play for Washington in 1971, reportedly half in advance, an eye-popping amount under the circumstances. While Flood was desperate, he didn't want to do anything that might undermine his legal appeal. But with assurances from Miller and others, he accepted Short's offer and reported to the team's winter training facility out of shape. By his own admission, Flood had spent most of his year away from the game, quote, betting and boozing. While most players silently supported Flood, fans did not, fueled by owners and sports writers. Brad Snyder, author of A Well-Paid Slave, a Flood biography published in 2006, said, quote, most of the sports writers were in the pockets of the owners. This was not a liberal baseball press. Some of the game's biggest stars were speaking out against Flood, including Carl Yastrzemski of the Boston Red Sox and Harmon Killebrew of the Minnesota Twins. Even Ted Williams and Frank Howard had been critical, although they said all the right things once Flood put on a Senator's uniform. Flood's fan mail became hate mail. Instead of sprinting across the outfield, chasing down deep threats, he was getting death threats. 5 a day, according to Gibson. Flood reached base 3 times on opening day 1971, but clearly was not the player he had once been. 2 days later, a 3-judge panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit ruled unanimously against Flood. Any attempt to concentrate on playing baseball was futile. By the end of the week, he had been benched by Williams, and by the end of the month, he had fled the country once again, this time for good. He apologized to Short in a cryptic telegram, quote, a year and a half is too much. Very serious personal problems, mounting every day. Flood did not appear with his attorneys when the final appeal was argued in March 1972 before the Supreme Court. In June, the court ruled 5-3 in favor of the owners. Justice Lewis Powell recused himself, citing the fact he owned stock in Anheuser-Busch, owner of Flood's former team in St. Louis. The majority opinion deflected to Congress to ultimately take up the question of eliminating baseball's antitrust exemption. As Miller had predicted, the suit did not end well for Kurt Flood, but it put pressure on the owners and emboldened the players. In the years that followed, Miller seized on opportunities to win 2 legal proceedings, resulting in free agency for 3 specific players, Jim Catfish Hunter, Andy Messersmith, and Dave McNally. By 1976, the floodgates were open. Flood had clearly started something. Between 1972 and 1995, the players either went out on strike or the owners locked out the players 8 times. The regular season schedule was impacted 4 times, including 3 opening days. As Miller also predicted, Flood never saw a dime of the game's new riches for players. The downward spiral of his life continued for more than 15 years until he was rescued from alcoholism by friends, family, and a familiar characteristic, his own determination. By 1989, time had healed some wounds within the baseball establishment. Flood returned to the game he loved as commissioner of the short-lived Senior Professional Baseball Association, a Florida-based league of retired players. In 1993, Flood finally accepted his 7th gold glove, earned a generation before in St. Louis, but never collected. Under the headline, Dred Scott in Spikes, conservative columnist and baseball junkie George Will wrote on the occasion, quote, Kurt Flood, a 165-pound whippet of a center fielder, could outrun most fly balls, but it took him 24 years to catch up to his 1969 Gold Glove Award. There was poetry and portent, Will continued, in the fact that Kurt Flood's career blossomed in St. Louis, the city where Dred Scott had taken his case to court. In 1966, the Cardinals moved into a new stadium that is located just along Fungo from the court where Scott, a slave, argued that he lived on free soil and therefore should be free. Talk about lighting a long fuse. That one led to 4 years of civil war. Scott's case went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, which ruled against him and thereby against the strong running tide of history. It was not the last time the Supreme Court would blunder when asked whether a man can be treated like someone's property. Of even greater personal significance than leading a league of old-timers or placing another trophy on his mantle was an invitation in 1994 from the MLBPA to speak to a gathering of active players to inspire solidarity, remind them of the freedoms they now enjoyed, and most important to Flood, accept their gratitude. On January 20, 1997, Flood died of throat cancer. Among the eulogists at his funeral were conservative columnist Will and liberal icon Reverend Jesse Jackson. "Baseball didn't change Curt Flood. Curt Flood changed baseball," Jackson said. "Curt lost a case and won the race. Curt opened the floodgates. He freed black, white, and brown. Curt Flood must go in the Hall of Fame," Jackson added. "Curt is the winner. People are better. America is better." Not a single then-current Major League player attended the service. The day after Flood died, Senate Bill 53 was introduced in the 105th Congress, taking up what the Supreme Court had suggested 25 years earlier in Flood v. Kuhn. The bill was signed into law on October 27, 1998, formally giving Major League Baseball players the same rights under antitrust laws as other professional athletes. It was officially, and appropriately, the Curt Flood Act of 1998. In 1999, Time magazine included Flood on their list of the 10 most influential athletes of the 20th century, joining, among others, Muhammad Ali, Pele, Babe Ruth, and of course, Jackie Robinson. By the early decades of the 21st century, Flood had faded from the forefront of baseball history, perhaps cherished only by Cardinals fans of the 1960s and those players who had taken the time to learn about the sacrifice and, eventually, solidarity that contributed to their current freedom. But two events in December 2019 brought Flood back into the headlines: the 50th anniversary of his famous letter to the commissioner, and Marvin Miller's unlikely enshrinement in the Baseball Hall of Fame, an honor some see as incomplete without Flood there to join him. On December 18, 2019, the New York Yankees introduced their newest free agent acquisition, 29-year-old right-handed pitcher Gerrit Cole. He just signed the most lucrative contract in baseball history, reportedly $324 million, with an annual average value of $36 million. At the press conference, Cole mastered the obligatory list of those to thank: God, family, his agent, coaches, and teammates. But before thanking the Steinbrenner family and Yankees management, he did something no newly minted multimillionaire in baseball had done before. He publicly thanked Marvin Miller and Curt Flood. Just 10 days before Cole's unveiling at Yankee Stadium, Miller had finally been elected to the Hall of Fame after three different iterations of special committees failed seven times over a 17-year period to enshrine the executive acknowledged by most as the one who changed the business of professional sports for the better by orchestrating a system that allowed players to eventually choose where they wanted to play. "I would be remiss if I didn't mention Marvin Miller specifically," Cole said. "We've seen competitiveness blossom and free agency blossom, and he played a major role in that. Curt Flood as well. Challenging the reserve clause was essential to the blossoming sport we have today." "He lost the 1970 season and lost in the Supreme Court," Will wrote of Flood's significance. "But he had lit a fuse. The national pastime is clearly better because of that. But more important, so is the nation, because it has learned one more lesson about the foolishness of fearing freedom." For Box Score, Play-by-Play, Kurt Flood's buyout, and more. Visit openingday5050.com.